Good evening, everyone. I am your host, Jason Miles, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. This is live. This is not a pre-record, and we started on time. There's nothing like having a returning guest, doesn't have tech problems, crew shows up early, started on time, still offended that somebody said, oh no, if the show's not on time, that's how you know it's live, and if it's on time, that's how you know it's pre-record. Not cool, dude. Not cool. Before we start, if you're new to the channel, please hit subscribe. Don't forget to hit that notification bell so you are alerted whenever we go live. We will be going to the Champagne Room right after the show, where I want to have a conversation with you guys about ideas of authenticity in hip-hop. I was on a panel earlier today on the Theory Underground channel. I was on two panels today, one about hardcore music, another about hip-hop. Definitely they talked about theory, lots and lots of theory. But I had some questions about authenticity. Yeah, had a really great conversation. And I was like, you know what? I want to take this conversation to you guys. I would love to hear what you guys have to say about that. And also, I want to talk to you guys about cooning. I mean, yeah, that didn't come out right. But the whole definition of it has kind of been changed around. So the Champagne Room is going to be a lot of fun. This show is going to be very engaging as well. Also, I'd like to send a massive shout out to all the people that subscribe on YouTube, Twitch, every audio podcast format that we are on. And of course, thank you to all the lovely patrons. You guys are the engine in the TIR machine that keeps us going. You are the engine. You're in it, and you are it. As you can tell, I've had a long day. I've been doing a lot of podcasting, talking since 11 a.m. is now 6 p.m. But I'm ready to go. I'm ready to go. That being said, let's bring in the TIR crew. Coming all the way live from Miami, Florida, he is my homie, my co-host, my dog. He is the man of the Mau Mau Hour. He is the Pascal Robert.
Peace and greetings to the chat. Peace and greetings to the audience. Peace and greetings, Jason Miles.
How are you?
I am fine.
I have some interesting questions to ask you tonight in the Champagne Room. I'm excited to get your take on this stuff. I wish you would have been with me on this panel for some of the things they were saying about hip-hop.
Were there adherence to certain theories about hip-hop that we've debunked in the past?
No, it's just a different take, and there's a conversation I've been having with Bertram Cooper about black camp and just kind of cooning, and where is the line? So I'd love to get your opinion on that. I have some videos, of course, that I set aside. From some of our favorite TIR Champagne Room artists. So I'm excited to get your take on these. And let's bring in the late, the faceless voice of reason, the M2 Song.
Hello, hello. It is nice to be here. Happy post Canada Day.
When was Canada Day?
It was, was it the first? Canada. It was the first. Happy belated.
Pascal, you know what Canada Day is?
Family in Canada, man.
I mean, we have Cuba.
No, man, there's a lot of Haitians in Canada, bro.
A lot.
There's a lot of Haitians out here in Mexico.
That's a newer development.
That's true. Those are newer Haitians.
I've been asking them if they know either one of you, and they just look at me strange. So I'm assuming they're not your family. But there is a significant amount. do look at me strange, and I'm all excited to see him. Toussaint, how are you?
I'm doing all right. I'm doing all right. Staying cool in the heat.
Is it hot in New York?
It's decent.
I want to ask Pascal how hot is it in Miami, but that's kind of
90 degrees.
Damn.
But that's not really that bad.
Yeah.
Not for Miami.
Was it super humid? Are you suffering?
Yeah, we've been having a lot of rain.
Hot rain? Like,
yes.
Ugh.
Steamy rain.
Yeah.
Oh.
Humidity.
That gator bath.
You call it a gator bath?
That gator bath, man. I heard that when the storms are really bad in Florida, the alligators like fly from different, they fly into different yards.
Fly?
Like storm winds can pick them up like Sharknado and they can fly into different yards. That's what I heard.
What kind of MF Doom cartoons have you been watching?
It's Florida, so I believed it.
Like, seriously.
It sounds like a lyric from like some kind of bad MF Doom album. I'm like,
are there alligators in the sewers in New York, Tucson? Is that
they're in the toilets. You gotta watch out.
Jesus.
That's why you have to look before you sit.
I was scared. You know, it's funny you say that. The first time I was in Florida, I went to go for a jog, and I was staying in a house with some friends, and before I walked out the door, one of them stopped me. They're like, "Hey, just in case you see an alligator or something, just zigzag, because they can't really catch you if you zigzag."
I can't. They're like bullets.
And I was like, "Oh, fuck that." Yeah. Stationary runs. Oh, exercise ain't that important.
They're actually very fast animals.
For those that don't know Pascal, when you don't see him on the show, he's wrestling alligators.
Oh man. Now I would not mind trying some cooked alligator.
I mean, can't that be made possible for you? Aren't they in the supermarket?
I mean, it's not like Publix is out here selling alligator.
They not? It's Florida. Come on.
He's not that far south. When you get a little further south, you can get alligator at the Publix.
I believe
it. I heard alligator is kind of like the chicken tenders of the sea, of the ocean, of the lake.
Chicken tenders, like it's kind of gross for a child's palate. It's weird. It's like chicken with a fishy taste. That's weird. I ate a fair amount of alligator when I worked in the South.
Louisiana?
Yes.
It was pretty common. Someone says it's really dry. I guess it depends on how it's cooked. No, it wasn't that dry. But you can get gator bites. Certain restaurants have like gator bites.
Gator bites.
I would assume you were that far south, Pascal, where you could get that, no?
I probably could. I have to look into it. Gator bites.
I don't know if you guys saw the chat. Somebody said that this just in, the Armenians are down. The alligators are flying.
I did hear that. The storm winds pick them up and drop them in different people's yards.
That does sound like the ramblings of that woman. Your knees are down.
The scariest thing about South Florida and Florida in general is our governing political structure. That's more scary than the weather.
So if you had Toussaint's flying alligator fantasy or Ron DeSantis as the overlord of Florida for another 8 years, what would you rather have?
Oh man. I mean, obviously the MF Doom like cartoon with the alligator fantasy is problematic.
Problematic.
Ron DeSantis just really takes the curl out of your Jerry curl, boy. I mean,
man, that's a horrible thing to be known for.
That is.
Just straightening curls.
You just went just take the Jerry curl
all over the floor.
He is like the
Ron DeSantis, strong enough to give your chest hairs a perm. Canada's right-wing turn. Speaking of right-wingers, Canada is a country that is known for its progressivism, especially juxtaposed with its southern neighbors in the United States. But there is a growing right-wing presence in Canada that may threaten its status quo. From Jordan Peterson to the Ford family to the trucker convoy, the growing right-wing extremism is gaining momentum in Canadian politics. Is this all part of the Trump effect? Does a growing right sentiment arise with the ascension of former President Donald Trump? Make Canada great again signs were seen after some high-profile hate crimes. We have with us returning guest, scholar Colin B. Antis, to tell us all about this. Please welcome Colin Bruce Antis.
That's the best ovation I've gotten all week.
That's not how you walk into Denny's? Colin, you forced us to read some disturbing news about Canada. Want to read about their imperialism and then shit on them for that. But now we had to talk about a growing right sentiment in Canada and be reminded of actually some of the more horrible hate crimes that have happened there in the last 4 years. Now, as much as we'd like to blame this all on Jordan Peterson and Stefan Molyneux, it's probably unfair. What do you think the one of the causes is for this growing right-wing extremism?
Well, it's been growing for a long time. And I saw somebody put in the chat that, haven't we been drifting to the right for a long time? Yeah, we've been steadily drifting to the right for a few decades economically, and that's been also fueling some of the things that are happening socially as well. I think also that Canada, and I want to be kind of clear about my thesis. Yeah, the hate crimes are growing in Canada right now. But I actually think the whole political economic system is on a razor's edge right now. So I think Canada could be looking at basically a massive, it's facing the possibility of a massive makeover that would undo all of the positive things that you mentioned about what people think of as the Canadian legacy. We are really looking at like a systemic shift right now. It's not a few isolated incidents. This is a gathering storm. And it's not, you know, a lot of it is mimicking the stuff that has come out since the Trump presidency. That's true. But this is the culmination of neoliberal failure in Canada. So it's not a quick trend, and it's not isolated to a small group of people. We're facing some systemic issues in Canada. And unless those get dealt with, this is just going to keep on building. And it could build to more decay and more extremism over time gradually. But we also could be looking at something like the kind of makeover that Margaret Thatcher gave to Great Britain. And we could be looking at an economic collapse, to be honest. We are not that different than the position the United States was around 2005, 2006, economically.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, jump on in.
So a lot of these hate crimes that, you know, and I feel bad. I did forget about some of the, there was a shooting at the mosque. There's a lot of anti-Muslim hate. Going on in Canada right now. Is there a specific province where this is more prevalent, or is it kind of all over? It's, you know, Canada is about what, a quarter immigrant? Quarter of the population is immigrant.
Yeah.
And there seems to be a growing nationalism within Canada.
Right. That's very unusual.
Is this a newer phenomenon?
Yeah, Canada historically was a country that was kind of thought of as a little bit ahead of other countries in terms of dwindling down nationalism. We were such a huge decentralized landmass with so many different cultures in different places that we didn't really have a chance to build nationalism the way other countries did. And so when other countries after the Second World War had disillusionment with the idea of nationalism, Canada was seen at that time as being ahead of the curve. And that was really celebrated in the 60s when we held the World Expo. And it was this idea of, Canada the kind of decentralized federation rather than Canada the kind of central nation state that was really celebrated. So what's very interesting, and this is where the Trump mimicry comes in, is that a lot of this nationalism that you're seeing pop up in Canada right now is a very fabricated aesthetic. And people are either really into it or they're looking at it like, what the fuck is this? But there's a lot more of the what the fuck is this going on right now.
Pascal, I know you have questions.
What is the root of the political economic downturn in Canada that makes the economic crisis seem so dire? Are there something in the securities markets? Is it something in the housing market? Can you point to certain trends? Is it a demographic problem with demographic shifts moving downward that require a replenishment in population? What exactly are the political economic issues that make it seem like a society in crisis?
Yeah, you've named a lot of them. We certainly have the fact that we rely very much on, first off, the housing crisis. The housing crisis is very, very big in Canada.
But countrywide, or mainly in British Columbia?
Countrywide, absolutely countrywide. And not just in big cities, because what you're seeing are people leaving the big cities and flooding the markets in the smaller communities. But also within that, you have the phenomenon of real estate investment trusts in Canada. So big money buying up big, big amounts of property and profiting off of this entire cascade effect that is happening right now. But I should, maybe I can lay it out issue by issue. But maybe it would be better for me to look at kind of the structural formation of Canada, because it also has to do with the electoral system and what has changed in terms of our political parties and how that has cascaded into an economic effect that is spanning several decades. Like, some of this goes back to austerity that began to pop up in the 80s and then more in the 90s. And it didn't look like austerity in other places because we still had the semblance of the old welfare state. But we were step by step going off the track of a kind of social democratic Scandinavian style country. We were kind of on the heels of that in the mid 20th century. And so we've really veered away from that in the last handful of decades. So none of this, a lot of it feels like a new phenomenon right now, but that's just things hitting their peak. This has been building for many decades. So would you like me to go through it issue by issue, or would you like
me?
Okay, sure.
Let's start with financial.
Yeah, financial. Well, so what has happened is this. I'll start with the financial side of things, but then maybe I should play into the politics a bit more.
Sure.
In the 1970s, so we were building a pretty substantial welfare state through the mid-20th century. In the 40s, we had Tommy Douglas form the first socialist government in North America with the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation in Saskatchewan. They created a number of crown corporations. That's what we call a nationalized enterprise, as well as gradually creating the first single payer health insurance system. By 1970, that had gone national. So we were kind of clipping at the heels of a social democratic Scandinavian style country at that time. From 1969 to 84, Pierre Trudeau, the father of the current prime minister, was the prime minister for almost the entire time. And he expanded the welfare state, but ran a deficit almost every year. And this confused a lot of people. There were debates over whether it was good that the welfare state was expanding or bad that it was coming with these deficits. And to confuse matters further, his first finance minister initially proposed that this be totally costed by taxes on the rich. The rich then formed a capital strike, or threatened a capital strike. So there was class warfare fought by the capitalists. That tax reform was put into, it was sent away. This sounds like I'm going back. It sounds like it's like very removed from what's happening now, but it sets up this cascade effect. Because what happens next is that finance minister disappears. Then a new finance minister comes in called John Turner, who went on to be prime minister for about 6 months. He was known as a business liberal. And a part of what happened next was the deficits were run in part to alleviate the taxes on the rich. So this confuses the whole spectrum. What you get is people not sure if this is left wing, right wing, or center. And their answer to that is going to depend on whether they liked it or not and who they're identifying as the bad guys. And that's true to this day. What happens after that is neoclassical economics comes in full swing, as everybody sort of knows. And that was Milton Friedman and then Reagan and Thatcher and all of that. And you get this cascade of governments after that, one after another, claiming that they're going to clean up the debt of the previous government and handle inflation. So in the 80s, the conservatives come in and they make that claim. They have some very, very big elections, form some of the biggest governments in all of Canadian history. But then they get the debts of the George H.W. Bush. It's the economy, stupid recession, right? So they lose all credibility on that issue. And they also put through regressive tax systems on sales taxes. And they put through, they signed NAFTA. They were nowhere near as far to the right as Reagan and Thatcher, but they took a piece, they took a corner of that and were a part of this general kind of neoliberal influence in Canada that was another step away from the trajectory we were on in the mid 20th century. When they get into the 1990s, they get completely decimated and they stay decimated until the early 2000s. But when they're replaced, it's not with a left-wing alternative. The Liberals come back, but this time the Liberals are saying they're going to clean up the debts of the Conservative Party. How do they do that? Cuts. And one of the things that they do especially is go after housing and basically stop any kind of cooperative housing in Canada, as well as other forms of social housing. They get back to balanced budgets, brag about it like crazy. You're familiar with this story around the world, the Clinton consensus, the end of history, Tony Blair in Great Britain, this sense of a not so right-wing version of neoliberalism being the grand success story, but then things get rocky in the early 2000s. Then comes in Harper, and how Harper comes about is very important as well, but I'll skip that for now, but it has relevance to our present moment. Mm-hmm. Harper gets in through the first past the post electoral system. He holds power for about a decade. We get more big deficits through the Great Recession, the financial crisis of 2008. But he's bragging that they're much lower than in other countries, and he's moving back towards a balanced budget faster than other countries. And he even tried to sort of cook the books to make it look like he had gotten there towards the end of his term. He was really about $6 billion shy, but and I hope I'm not going too fast for folks. So then finally comes in Justin Trudeau. And Trudeau says he's willing to deficit spend. But this time, by the time Justin Trudeau comes along and says he's willing to deficit spend, we're well into a neoliberal status quo. We're very far removed from the trajectory that we were in the mid-20th century. Now, meanwhile, all of the time that these governments were talking about, oh, we're going to get rid of debt, we're dealing with the debt, we're the party of fiscal responsibility, and having this competition for who's the party of fiscal responsibility and economic growth, what's actually happening? Is any of that debt actually being gotten rid of? No, of course not. Every dime of it was turned into household debt. It was all just put onto credit cards, student loans, car loans, and mortgages. So that whole time, what was happening was housing was gradually getting more expensive. School was getting a lot more expensive. The manufacturing jobs were declining. The unions were weakening. The tax system was becoming less progressive, more regressive. And the entire political spectrum across Canada was narrowing and shifting to the right, narrowing and shifting to the right, narrowing and shifting to the right. So that's how we get to where we are now. To give a snapshot of where we are economically, in 1980, household debt per $1 of disposable income for the average Canadian citizen was 66 cents. It is now $1.85 of household debt for every $1 of disposable income in the country. And total household debt in Canada is 107% of total GDP in the country. So what we have seen is Canada step by step, it's not just the current moment, this has been building for decades, but we have become a rentier economy. We're extremely unequal. We're accelerating the rate at which we are unequal at a record high level. So we're very capitalist in the sense of a division of workers and owners, but it's actually not industrial capitalism. Our investment in the means of production is actually pretty low. It's real estate and financialization. Mm. And the chances of that being fixed right now are very, and I should mention, this is like, I would like to get into what the politics are fighting within this context, but this is the context regardless of who's in power. So like the system right now, we still have a pretty high standard of living in Canada, but it has stagnated intergenerationally, it has declined. And the prospects moving forward are that either we will steadily decline from here, slowly, or there could be the kind of collapse that you saw in the United States in 2007, 2008. But that's true regardless of who is in power. This is a rentier capitalist state that has really taken over Canada in a major, major way. It is, and over 100 of our members of parliament, so our parliament is made up of 338 members, over a third of them are invested as landlords or in real estate investment trusts. So our politicians are profiting off of this housing crisis. That includes about 50% of the Conservative members of parliament, about a third, or actually a little more than a third, of the Liberal members of parliament. But even the NDP, they're much better. That's the New Democratic Party, historically our Social Democratic Party, now more vaguely of a progressive party. But they have about 16 to 20% of their members of parliament invested in real estate investment trusts and in landlording. And the Green Party has two seats in the House of Commons. One of them is invested, so they're batting 50% as well. So nobody has their hands clean on this issue, which means that it is really hard for people to have any kind of faith that any of this could be dealt with, or to even see a path through the electoral system that this could be dealt with. So that was a lot, but I hope that, was that fairly clear? Did that kind of...
Yeah.
Oh, goodness, yeah. I mean, it's a very grim picture. Toussaint, I know there's something you wanted to add.
One moment.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask about just the general, what is your right wing sort of like? I know you're exposed to a lot of American media and what our right wingers are like. How are yours different? Does your right wing dabble in cryptocurrency, anti-vax sentiment, conspiracy theories?
Yep.
What are we talking here?
Okay, so this is, I'm moving a little bit in the reverse order that I originally thought. I was going to sort of start with the electoral system and then move into the economics, but I'll go back into the electoral system gradually. So I'll go to the parties first. So this is a very, Canada has a terrible electoral system, and I can describe that in a minute, and it's part of the reason the current circumstances are as dangerous as they are. But a part of the reason that Canada has put up with our terrible electoral system for so long, some of it is because sometimes the popular vote and the electoral vote would kind of look like, would accidentally be in a line. But a big part of it was that in the 20th century, actually our Conservative Party was not altogether that right wing. That's for a handful of reasons. They were always the opposite of American conservatives. They were empire loyalists. They were the people who lost the American Revolution, right? Mm-hmm. As Canada in the 20th century became more separated from Great Britain, we never fully separated. We technically have a king, but I'll try and say that without vomiting all over the screen. As we became more separated from Great Britain in the 20th century, they became more of a kind of elitist party, not very democratic, but they believed that they were the objective purveyors of the common good. So they prided themselves, they at least claimed to be non-ideological and to put policy before party. Whether they did that very well or not is, you know, that's a matter of debate. But they were more sympathetic to a welfare state, inclusive growth type things, and they actually often ran to the left of the Liberal Party in the 20th century very successfully. Really? And this will kind of blow people's minds today. But in the 1970s, which was the last time Canada had the big inflation crisis, the Conservative Party was led by a guy called Robert Stanfield. And Stanfield had actually declared himself to be, at a younger stage in his life, a socialist because of the impact the Great Depression had on him. He saw what unfettered capitalism could do, and he remembered it. And when he was running in the 1970s, he actually campaigned on the government intervening and setting price controls at the cost of the corporations to make things affordable for Canadians. So very different from what we think of as a conservative today. Now, this is really important because it plays into the issue that Canada has right now. And I was saying to Pascal before, I don't actually think Canadians are fully aware of how dangerous this moment is, because it's not just that the Conservative Party shifted to the right over time. That's not what happened. There was a little bit of that, certainly when neoliberalism came in, they rode a bit of that wave, but there was actually a different party. And most Canadians do not know this, especially my age or younger. There was a party called the Reform Party that was started in the late 80s by a guy called Preston Manning. The Reform Party had no connection to those 20th century conservatives. The Reform Party was, and to finish my thought about the electoral system, sorry, that meant that if the public voted center left and the power share looked completely wrong, like what went to what party didn't have anything to do with the popular vote, it could still end up being basically a center left government. And so that quelled a lot of outrage. What happened was in the late 80s, a party called the Reform Party was started. The Reform Party was the full thing. Ayn Rand, Milton Friedman, Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, mixed in with social right-wing politics that are much more common in Alberta than in the rest of Canada. So they were a very, very right-wing party. They got a good following in Alberta, but they always sort of capped out as a federal party. In the late 90s, they had kind of plateaued, but the Conservative Party was also massacred at that time. So in the early 2000s, Stephen Harper reaches across the aisle and he says, let's merge. And so the two parties, then actually the Reform Party technically changed its name to the Alliance Party first and then merged. So if you're looking for the record, you'll see the Alliance Party merging with the Conservative Party. But basically the Conservative Party had nudged a bit to the right, but then there was this totally right-wing party that had nothing to do with their history. They merged together. So we thought that Stephen Harper was the most right-wing prime minister Canada would ever see, because he was already probably the most right-wing prime minister we'd had in three quarters of a century, if not more. And he was losing the popular vote every election. He was relying on our electoral system for power. And then Canadians strategically voted in 2015 to make sure he got out, and he got crushed in 2015. But after that takes place, is this making sense to everybody? Do you need me to stop and clarify?
Oh, no, we are following along right with you. You are being very concise. You're killing it.
After Stephen Harper loses in 2015, the Conservatives go through a kind of identity crisis. This culminates in basically a civil war within the Conservative Party of Canada. There's a two-year span in which they change leadership three times. So kind of like what was going on with the British Tories. In one of those elections, the guy who finishes second, a guy called Maxime Bernier, starts an alternative party. He leaves the Conservatives in fury and he forms an alternative party called the People's Party of Canada, which I know you've discussed in a previous episode. They're basically a Daily Wire party, right? And that's not an overstatement. They've never gotten a seat in the House of Commons, but they get 3 to 7% of the popular vote, depending on what the polling shifts, but between 3 to 7% of the popular vote. Within our system, that can be an absolute deal breaker because our system is not very democratic at all. So they're taking, this is a serious problem for the Conservative Party, but on the third election for their leadership, they elect a guy called Pierre Poilievre. Now, this is the part that's really key. Pierre Poilievre was never Conservative Party of Canada. He had no connection whatsoever to those more moderate kind of sometimes running to the left of the liberals, conservatives from the 20th century. He had nothing to do with them. He was Reform Party through and through growing up until the merger took place. And he was extremely hostile towards the old conservatives and the more moderate members. Then the merger took place and he became the right wing of Stephen Harper's cabinet. He was known as Harper's main attack dog. Pierre Poilievre, forget Karl Marx. Adam Smith, if he ever met this guy, would vomit all over him. Because Adam Smith wanted free markets, but he was labor theory of value. So he didn't like landlords and speculators and usurers and monopolists. Pierre Poilievre is the full postmodern theology of neoclassical economics. He is literally a landlord and a crypto speculator who has never had a laboring job, who made his fortune, and I mean fortune, because he started in his early 20s, stumping for the rich on the taxpayer's dime. And then he took those fortunes and he invested it in landlording and speculation. And at a time when greedflation has been so high in Canada that we've seen American corporate bankers saying it could destroy capitalism if it keeps on like this, he won't go after it. He's insisting it's public spending, public benefits, deficit spending, and that the only cure is austerity. And he won't even touch the monopolists who are soaking up so much through inflation right now. So he's way, way over there. And he got the leadership of the Conservative Party with help. I hate to talk about Jordan Peterson every single time I come on here, but he got the leadership with help from Jordan Peterson. Jordan Peterson actually made an advertisement with him encouraging people to sign up to get their membership with the Conservative Party so that they could vote specifically to vote Pierre Poilievre as the leader.
And well, how powerful is Jordan Peterson as a kind of a pop figure in the culture of Canada? I mean, we know how big he is here in the States.
Okay, so this is the thing. And I
track you on that, but I think that's kind of important to point out. Is Jordan Peterson have enough juice back home in Canada to do a series of television ads to really get somebody into power?
So here's the thing. This is why I was going to sort of start with the electoral system.
Sorry.
I'm sorry to be so technical with the electoral system, but it is really important. Our electoral system is very, very bad. And like I say, there were incentives in the past to not get as outraged as we should have been. But now it's increasingly biting us in the ass. So here's Canada's electoral system. Mm-hmm. We are not a two-party system. We have technically five parties with seats in the House of Commons. That's kind of like our Congress. One of those is the Bloc Québécois, which is historically a separatist party for the province of Quebec. So I don't know if they count as a federal party. They might say they're a national party, but not a federal party. There are technically five parties with seats in the House of Commons. Theoretically, that could have made us a more democratic nation. But the thing is, we do not have proportional representation in Canada. It's the first past the post electoral system. So what that means is that I've been in many ridings where there have been three competitive candidates and then others who get maybe 10% of the popular vote. And one would get 33%, one would get 30%, and one would get 27%. The way that works out in our electoral system is the candidate who gets 33% wins the seat. The other 67% of the popular vote gets deleted. And then you go to the next riding and you do the same thing. And you don't vote for prime minister in Canada. You vote for your local representative, and the party that gets enough local representatives to form the government to become prime minister. So that's how you end up setting the agenda in Canada. To get a majority government means you need to get enough seats that you have more seats than all the other parties put together. That means you don't need to negotiate with anybody. You don't need to form a coalition government. You have total power for the rest of the term. Usually, the magic number, it's malleable, but the magic number usually to get into a situation of a majority government is only about 36% of the popular vote. And most of our majority governments have had 37, 38, 39% of the popular vote somewhere in there. Pierre Poilievre is sitting around 33 to 37% of the popular vote right now, depending on what poll you look at. And it looked like when he was a little lower, he was not getting the critical mass to use the first past the post electoral system. Now it's looking like he might have the critical mass to actually form a government. So in terms of Jordan Peterson's sway and the far right sway, and this is kind of why I'm saying these were not isolated incidents and why there's a big systemic issue here. And there's the possibility of this having really calamitous results for Canada is because they don't have to win the majority of the people. And Canada almost always votes center-left. Ontario almost always votes center-left. In their provincial elections, we usually get right-wing majority governments. About half the time, we get right-wing majority governments in Ontario. You don't need to actually win the masses over. You need to win the minority over. That gets you power through the first past the post electoral system. That's how Harper was in power for as long as he was. And that's why Canada was sort of poised to keep on shifting to the right. It was really hard to build an alternative that could break out of that mold once that shift started to happen. So when we talk about Jordan Peterson's influence, his ability to get more people into the Conservative Party and get Pierre Poilievre in the leadership of that party, if Pierre Poilievre can get 36% of the popular vote, then yeah, Jordan Peterson has had huge influence in terms of who the leader of Canada is. He doesn't need to get 65% of Canadians on board. Does that make sense?
Sadly, Pascal, I know you want to follow up.
So, is Poilievre, what is his agenda in terms of what he's proposing that makes him such a kind of anathema of a right-wing figure?
Yeah, he's been pretty, I mean, he is sort of maybe being a little less vague about just, or a little more vague about just how right-wing he is right now. But his agenda has pretty much been unchanged throughout his entire career. Austerity, pay-as-you-go financial scheme for the government, which basically makes it kind of illegal for the government to deficit spend. His agenda around how he gets to balance budgets is cut social programs and rights to work anti-union legislation, as well as basically completely unregulated financial sector. So those are kind of his main agenda points. And he would be the kind of person who would do the kind of makeover to Canada that Margaret Thatcher gave to Great Britain. That's
you're basically talking about maybe gutting or privatizing the healthcare system, which kind of is the last thing you guys have, I would assume.
Yeah, what he would probably do is do it by degrees, which is the way, you know, that's the we've seen some of that already done in Great Britain, where they try and basically make the healthcare system work worse and worse and worse, and then create more. And we're seeing this also in Ontario already, where the government is, we have a conservative, people might remember a handful of years. Yeah, that's right. So there is Rob Ford, the crack smoking mayor of Toronto, and his brother that was the headline all around the world, was the crack smoking mayor of Toronto. His brother is the premier of Ontario now. It, through the first past the post system, Ontario voted center left, got a right wing government. And he's been doing things like looking at the pieces of the healthcare system, specialized pieces around, you know, surgeries and things that he can open up to the private sector step by step. Probably that's what Pierre Poilievre would do, because Canadians historically have identified with our single payer healthcare system more than probably any other element other than like maple syrup. So that's like the most Canadian source of pride that we have. He would probably do it by degrees, but everything else would get gutted lickety split.
It's called personal responsibility. Excuse you.
One of the flashpoint issues that are making it so easy for him to gain popularity?
A handful of things. One is the household debt issue, the housing issue. Another is that we have an overdose epidemic, the death of despair and the opioid crisis. So those are the kind of the main things. What's interesting about Pierre Poilievre, and he's very different from other leaders in Canada now and historically, is he will actually say that the system is going to shit. And that's not usually what a leader will do. A leader will disagree with a different party's policy on a given topic or something like that. But Pierre Poilievre is saying, like, everything in Canada is broken. Not broken yet, but it could be pretty soon. And so it's a message that resonates with a lot of people. But he isn't really putting forward solutions that people would actually find appealing. But what he is doing is a couple of things. The first is he's trying to, it's quite a task to spin Milton Friedman as anti-establishment, but that is what he is doing. Like, he is actually, and he has through his whole career given speeches on the virtues of Milton Friedman in the House of Commons. But he actually is trying to spin Milton Friedman as anti-establishment. And what he does is he claims he's going after gatekeepers. That's his catchphrase. So what he's going to do is, instead of talking about the public sector, he's going to talk about Trudeau and reckless spending. A part of that is that Trudeau is kind of, I mean, you know, it's easy to not like Trudeau. He is a schmarmy bastard who comes from a dynasty family. He has always been he's very insidery. Like, there's no question about that. So, I guess maybe I should take a quick step back and say another thing that happened that really changed the Canadian political spectrum with dire consequences for the entire center left. And Canada has a radical left at the grassroots level, but not really in terms of federal political representation. The center left is kind of everything in terms of federal political representation. Trudeau in 2015 ran to the left of the NDP. This was extremely unusual, but the NDP had become more kind of generically progressive. They had kind of left their social democratic roots. By that time, he ran to the left of them, got a majority government with 39% of the popular vote, and 63% of the popular vote went to him, the NDP, and the Greens. Okay, so he had no opposition. There was no public popular opposition to his agenda, and his agenda was fight climate change, fight inequality, fight Islamophobia, protect Indigenous rights, and electoral reform. And he swore up and down this would be the last election under the first past the post electoral system. Not long after he had total power through the first past the post electoral system, that agenda went in the garbage, and the first thing he scrapped was electoral reform. So when he went down to a minority government, part of that was that he lost some of the popular vote, and he's now sitting sort of 7-8% below where he was in 2015. But also, the people who had voted NDP, the people who had voted Green, but they were okay with Justin Trudeau he put forward in 2015. By the time you get to 2019, they do not like him at all. He has lost trust across the entire center-left spectrum, but he's also the main line of defense for the center-left spectrum. And so his approval ratings in across the country right now are sitting somewhere around 37%. He's a very, very unpopular prime minister. The vast majority of Canada says they would like a different prime minister. They're not clear on who they would like instead, but they say they would like a different prime minister. So to go back to Poilievre, a lot of it is just attacking Trudeau, blaming him for inflation, refusing to acknowledge that the corporations are causing a lot of the inflation problems and refusing to go after them at all. Instead, claiming he's going after gatekeepers, meaning the government, which really means, of course, the public sector. Trudeau's an easy target for these things. But the other thing that Pierre Poilievre is doing right now is he's saying something that is it's comical as soon as you look it up. Like anybody who brings up a quick graph on household debt will see that it is absurd that he could put it this way. But what he is saying is it wasn't like this before Trudeau, and it won't be like this after the Trudeau government. And he's claiming that the household debt crisis in Canada is a Trudeau-only phenomenon. Now, this is a remarkable piece of fiction. Not only had household debt been climbing through the entire neoliberal era, but if you look up the time when Harper was in power, it absolutely shot up at an unprecedented rate in Canada. He put it through the roof. Not only that, I don't like Trudeau at all, as you can probably tell from my from the way I'm talking about him. I think he's a total douchebag. But he actually has a much lower rate of the increase of household debt than actually Harper did, in part because it was a little lower when in the first years when he took power, but also because, and this tells you just how fake the Canadian economy has become. But when COVID hit and everything got shut down, and he had no choice but to issue relief checks and to suspend student debt repayments temporarily and to defer evictions temporarily, household debt for the first time in generations actually dropped by about 20 cents on the dollar. So there was this one huge dip that actually happened when the economy got shut down. That was the only time people could start repaying their debts in Canada. And so Trudeau artificially actually has a much lower rate of growth of the household debt than the Harper government did. And of course, the idea that Poilievre is putting forward is that if he comes to power, he will get us to balanced budgets. And he's claiming that government spending is causing the inflation. He'll get back to balanced budgets by cutting the public sector. That will lead to inflation coming down, interest rates coming down, and people will be wealthy again like the good old days before Trudeau. Of course, what's going to happen is, you know, he's going to turn it into household debt all over again. It'll be like trying to punch out a landmine. There is a possibility that he could bring household debt down in Canada, but the way it would happen is the way it happened in the United States, where there's a foreclosure crisis. But that's the only way that it's going to come down. So that's what he...
What is the nature of this household debt? Is it something like in America where we have credit card or personal debt, or is it really all mortgages? What is it tied up in exactly?
Majority is in mortgages. Majority is in mortgages. But every form of household debt in Canada is pretty bad right now. Student debt has been bad for a very long time. Credit cards.
I do have a question about student debt. Historically, your guys' universities were massively cheaper than going to school. Here in the States. Now that's changed?
Yeah. Yep. Well, I shouldn't say that that's changed exactly, because I know some schools in the US charge like 50 grand American a year or something like that. That is something that you do not see too much of in Canada. But yes, in Canada, it has become increasingly expensive since the late 70s, early 80s, when there were cuts, and it happened everywhere. It just didn't happen as extreme a case in Canada as it was in the United States. But it also happened here. And you know, the problem with making funding cuts to the universities and not making them tuition free on principle is it doesn't just mean that it gets a little more expensive. it changes the business model of the university, right? So what they have to do from that point forward is they have to charge more and more and more. They have to build rec and leisure facilities to attract more customers. They've got to focus on their partnerships with the private sector and build bigger schools, international students. And so what happens is it spirals out of control. And then at that point, it becomes more and more expensive to keep up. So it becomes a vicious cycle. And that's what's happened in Canada. I think the average Canadian a couple of years ago, I haven't looked at the latest data on this, but I know a couple of years ago, I'm sure it's worse now, the average Canadian was graduating with 28 grand of student debt when they left university. Now that's Canadian, so it's a little lower than the American student debt level, but it's probably now something like 30 grand, something like that, of student debt when they leave.
And when you talk about gutting certain social services, again, my knowledge of your country, basically the most of the time I spent was in the western end of Canada. A lot of time there.
Like Vancouver area?
Vancouver area, yeah.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of social services for drug use, AIDS. It's still bad. I mean, last time I was there was 2019.
Yeah.
You know, it's still bad. It's still very visible.
That's the thing. It's extremely visible. And that's a lot of, you know, Pierre Poilievre is going and making videos in the streets where it is most visible and then saying everything's broken in Canada.
It's been that way for some time. I mean, that was kind of the plan, which, you know, I don't know how you feel about it. It always felt to me like, okay, look, we can corral the drug use, which will also corral all the prostitution, will corral all the HIV, and all the Hep C. But we're going to make kind of a little hell zone in our downtown area.
Yeah.
But everybody, I don't want to say seemed fine with it. It just kind of was what it was.
There is a degree of that. It's especially bad in Vancouver for a few reasons. One of the reasons that doesn't get brought up that much, but it actually has to do with like the climate. Like people who are more likely to be homeless or houseless are probably going to head to the West Coast because that's where the climate is going to be more temperate. But so you're right. There was a tendency for a congregation to happen there that is longstanding. And Poilievre is blaming that on policies that are like safe supply policies. So that's one of the big things that he's targeting is the idea of safe supply. I think your description is pretty accurate. I think your description is pretty accurate.
I mean, when I was there, you know, someone had to. We played again. You're in Ontario, right?
I am, yeah.
So yeah, you wouldn't know, but there was a really nice venue we played, but they had to like watch you load in and out, and there was a person that was paid to watch your vehicle. So the only places where we had it happen in North America are Vancouver and Metro Detroit.
Right.
We're the only places where there was like that common. You were going to get robbed.
Right. Yeah.
And it wasn't just like they take your gear. People were taking whole vans.
Yeah. No, there are real problems. And the opioid crisis has hit Canada very hard. No question about that. Mm-hmm. But also a lot of this is being exacerbated by various, like it's a whole, there's nothing given about these circumstances. Like I think even, you know, the description that I gave earlier could be a bit misleading if I'm not careful about it, because it could sound like it was just sort of natural that these issues would congregate in certain places. That's not at all the case. Housing precarity in Canada has been going up for a long time. The number of people who either had stable jobs, middle class jobs, or were on a path to that, really, that's declined. Like people are incredibly precarious now. And so we've been sitting ducks in Canada for that opioid crisis and for some of those other issues. And so there is, like, it is, it can look like a hellscape in certain places. And you're right that there was like a sense of, okay, there's going to be a certain amount of permission and care for that. And that was kind of the humane way of dealing with it within a neoliberal context. But it didn't really challenge the neoliberal context itself that was producing those things at a much, much higher rate than ever needed to happen in the first place. And that's still the case. The debate has, like, that's kind of Canada narrowing and shifting to the right, narrowing and shifting to the right. Now the debate is over how best to handle those kinds of sites, and not nearly enough about, in fact, really not substantially about how do we get to the root causes of those scenarios, and how do we cut off those root causes and get to something better. That's just, people maybe will put a little bit of lip service towards that idea, but it's all talk and no walk.
That's the way it felt. I do want to ask one final question because it'll come up in the hour. And first of all, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Thank you so much for reaching out to me. This has been a great, extremely sad but informative episode. Will you be joining us in the Champagne Room?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. We're going to be talking a lot of black shit. Are you ready for this?
I'm used to it. I've got my notebook.
The four black people Colin knows, he goes, I learned a new word today. And
I'm not going to use it.
but seriously, how is this cutting of services and how is it going to affect the First Nations population? There's always a lot of lip service, especially in the Trudeau government. Tons of lip service given to the First Nation population. But when we look at who's suffering the most, especially in cities like Vancouver, look at Edmonton, it's the First Nations population.
Right.
So how is this going to affect them?
Yeah, there was a conference. I'm sorry, I'm going to get this a little bit wrong. I can't remember exactly what the conference was. It was one where it was an Indigenous conference, and it was one in which political leaders showed up to give sort of their vision for where they think Canada's going and how they intend to have respectful nation-to-nation relationship, which is what we talk about with Indigenous people here. There are supposed to be strong elements of self-governance for our Indigenous people within the Canadian context. So Pierre Poilievre didn't show up, but he did send a video, and he got booed for the video. And his speech was all about how he was going to cut red tape that got in the way of Indigenous people becoming successful capitalists. So I guess that's where Indigenous people are left with the vision of the future that's on the table right now. And I should close by saying, like, this, it is fixable. Like, Canada could walk back from this, but it's going to take organization. It's going to take serious organization. It would be good to see political parties have some leadership on this. I would love to see, it would be a whole other subject to get into what the NDP is and could be and should be. But, like, one simple thing that they could do, and historically their biggest role in Canada is to change the conversation. They haven't been doing that well right now. But one thing that they could do is tell their remaining MPs the housing crisis is too serious and they've got to divest, and to tell anybody who's going to run on an NDP ticket, we want to run a zero landlord slate and change the conversation and show that contrast against the other political parties. That's one thing that could happen. But I really think that what needs to happen overall is not from the political parties. I think we need to show them where to go. And I think that means getting all of our organizing groups and our unions on the same conference call and introduce the framework of a democratic economy and a properly democratic society, and show that that's the direction we want Canada to go, and we expect our political leaders to answer to that. And I think we have to change the entire framework for Canada to walk back from this cliff. It can be done. It's not currently likely to happen, but if we get our act together, it can be done. And then I think we can really talk about meaningful truth and reconciliation with our Indigenous people from there. So that's the note I'll close on.
His name is Colin Bruce Anthus. He's fired up today because he's talking about Canada, his home, the native land. We will be going into the champagne room. If you're not a patron and would like to hang out with us, have access to champagne rooms past and present, it's simple. Become a patron. Patreon.com/bitterlakepresents. Simple as that. Come join us for the fun. We're going to be playing Black Yacht Rock for Pascal. He does the Black Yacht Rock shimmy. If you don't want to make the he's giving you a little soft shoe. When the music, I can't play the music on the main show, they'll pull it down, but on the champagne room, oh, it's on. If you don't want to make the monthly or yearly commitment, hey, make the world better with TIR merch. Isn't that right, Tucson?
That's right.
Bam.
You can get yourself an Afro-pessimism shirt.
Anglo.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's a highly political mistake I just made.
You just made, well, when you guys don't see or hear from Tucson ever again, you'll know why. Because she betrayed us. She'll be on another black network talking all kind of mess, popping gum on air. Yes,
popping gum.
Thank you guys so much for hanging out with us. Colin, thank you very much. I sent you the link to the champagne room. Gang, you guys all got the link?
Yes, yes, y'all.
Everybody in the chat, you guys got the link?
We got the link, Jason, just in the show.
Okay. Thank you guys. And we are
out.